Welcome to Dates of Our Lives, a true crime and awareness podcast. I'm your host, Kenna. In this podcast, I meet with a new guest each episode to discuss the date that changed their life. These stories include, but are not limited to, missing persons cases, survivor tales, personal tragedies, and more. This podcast was created nearly a decade after my own personal experience. In 2015, I lost one of my sisters, Cameron, in a truly horrific way, and I have been searching for meaning ever since. I truly believe each person's story is unique and extremely important to share, and I wanted to create a safe space to make that possible. Please join me in bringing awareness to these events and allowing space for healing, one episode at a time. You can listen to Dates of Our Lives anywhere you get your podcasts. Dates of Our Lives is coming soon, and I can't wait to share it with you guys. Hello!
Hello!
Welcome back to another episode of Diagnosing a Killer. I'm Kenna.
I'm Quell.
How's it going?
Pretty good.
Pretty good, pretty good.
Not really. My nails are on fire.
I know. You had these press-ons that you... Well, we both do this. We buy press-ons because they freaking work, and they're cheap. I'm sorry for me. And they look like real acrylics, yeah. But we also glue them. Like, they're sticky, but we also use glue so that they stay longer. Mine lasted for 3 weeks last time I put them on.
Three weeks. It's just hit or miss.
And yours, like, won't come off.
These will not come off. I've lost only one nail, and then the rest I've been soaking in, you know, that extreme nail solution stuff for the last, like, hour, can't be good for your skin.
Right.
And they still just won't come off. I have three hanging on by a thread right now.
I can't even imagine. My nails are so brittle, like my real ones. Ugh. Ugh. I'm sorry.
That's the way I feel. I feel like I just ripped them.
Okay, new topic. We are going to get into this case. I'm really excited. But first, I do have a really nice message I've been meaning to read.
I'd like nice messages.
Yes, I'd like to read that. This is from listener Kaliana. If I mispronounce that, I apologize. Kaliana says, "Hello, I've been binging your podcast. I've only been listening to you guys for a couple months. I'm enjoying all of the content, especially the mental breakdowns. I'm currently going for my RN and I love the education. I recently had to put my dad in a behavioral unit to help him with his schizophrenia. Your podcast helped me understand what he's going through. Thank you for all the confidence and help you two have given me."
Wow.
I know.
Thanks, Kaliana. That's awesome.
Yeah, we received that message a few weeks ago, and I think I sent you a screenshot, and I, like, actually started crying. I was very touched, and I was very, like, I was like, I've made it. Like, we've done it, you know? Like,
yeah.
We have done what we set out to do, and thank you so much for sharing that with us, because that really warms our hearts to know that we were able to assist and give you some confidence and peace.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, most importantly, you know that you're not alone.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks again for that wonderful message. And we also just wanted to give a big shout out to our Patreon members. We definitely see you guys posting on our Patreon and commenting on those bonus episodes. Mm-hmm. We're really glad that you guys are enjoying that extra content that you get. And if you'd like to join our Patreon members, they do get an extra bonus episode each month. That is our tiers 3 and 4 Patreon members. And you just need to go to patreon.com/diagnosingakiller to gain access to that. We do have 4 tiers. In our tier 1, they will get ad-free mental breakdowns. Tiers 2, 3, and 4 will get ad-free every episode. And then again, those tiers 3 and 4 will get that additional bonus episode every month.
Yeah, absolutely. And on any podcast platform that you're using, don't forget to add us to your list. That way you get instant updates and instant downloads.
Yeah, definitely. Give us some follows, give us some reviews, because that actually helps us get our name out there more and attract more listeners and in turn be able to make more content.
Yeah.
And we just want to say really quickly, again, thanks for 73,000 downloads. Mm-hmm. We're getting up there to 100,000. We're going to make a big fuss about it when it happens.
So true.
But that's all you guys, so we really appreciate it.
Yeah, maybe we'll even do a merch giveaway or something for that.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Do you want to give everyone the rest of our social media handles before we get into this case?
Sure. You can check us out on social media anywhere at Diagnosing a Killer, other than X, formerly known as Twitter, which is at Killer Diagnosis. We also have a Cash App, PayPal, and Venmo if you would like to support us monetarily. We are going to get the website back up, I promise.
It's coming.
It's coming.
It was under maintenance.
Yes, exactly.
So yeah, you guys give us a follow if you don't already. Tell your friends if you think we're funny. I think we're funny, but yeah, I might just be vain.
Tell your friends, your family, your folks.
Yes. Triple oof. Okay, let's get into this case. This is actually a requested case, mm-hmm. but he's also been on my list for quite some time.
That's exciting.
No pun intended.
Oh, time?
No. List.
What? What do you mean, list?
Okay, so I know it sounded like I was making like a ticking noise when I went, when I was trying to do like the elbow jab. Like, so this is a request from listener Becca. Okay. And the reason I made a no pun intended joke is because we are talking about John List today.
Oh.
So he's been on my list for quite some time.
You got a mint on your pillow?
Yep, get it?
It's meant for you.
Okay, let's get into this. Ready?
Yes.
But first, as you may know, we are doing our content warning at the end of the episode for each other as to not ruin anything for the other person that is listening and to get genuine reactions, but you guys will not hear anything different, which means you will be hearing your content warning right about now. Content warning. This episode contains depictions of child neglect, substance abuse, murder of children, and suicide. If this episode is not for you, we encourage you to find another one of our episodes. Remember, your mental health is very important, and we love you.
Love you.
Bye. Never gets old. Okay. John Emil List was born on September 17, 1925, in Bay City, Michigan, to parents John Frederick List and Alma Barbara Florence List. Hmm. He would be the only child to his parents.
Oh.
1925.
That's bold.
It was the 30s.
Although I'm sure a lot of families couldn't afford a lot. This was during the Depression, or right after.
True. John Sr. was noted as being nearly 25 years older than Alma, and the two had only been married a year when John Jr. was born.
Hmm.
Both John Sr. and Alma were of German descent, and they would attend the local German Lutheran church. The family lived in a Victorian house in which they rented the upstairs apartment. Due to the limited amount of space, John Jr. slept in the living room and was noted as having no space for his things or hardly any privacy growing up.
That's gotta be rough.
Yeah. It's like everyone's just in my area.
Yeah. It's you're in the communal area mm-hmm. where everyone walks through, and yeah, that's gotta be rough.
Well, yeah, no privacy. Like when you're a child, like little, maybe it doesn't matter so much, but as you get older, of course, that privacy is important. Due to living in such a small open area, John grew up learning how to be very neat and clean, as his living space was also shared with his parents.
That's not gonna be a complex later.
John Sr. was noted as being less than interested in spending time with his son, and he would mostly deal with John Jr. through Alma, referring to him only as the boy.
That's not going to affect him later.
Oh, are you with the boy?
Like, the boy.
Like, it's not your child that you created.
Yeah.
Furthermore, John Sr. was considered the neighborhood mean guy, and he and John Jr. would rarely spend any time together. He was just kind of like a grump.
Do you think that maybe he had a child with Alma because Alma wanted a child?
I think that he didn't intend to have a child with Alma, and he was much older than her, so he was already over, like, the kid thing.
Yeah.
And then when it happened, he's like, eh.
Oh.
You know?
Mm,
I know. I mean, that's just speculation. I don't know.
Right.
I wasn't there.
Yeah. You asked him.
Yeah. He told me.
He told me.
On top of this, John Sr. owned and ran a local store, and he was noted as strongly disliking, like, the neighborhood children, and he would become upset when they would come into his store.
Hmm.
He's, like, in a candy store, and he's like, get out of here, you children. With his parents being extremely involved in the church, John was expected to uphold the same amount of faith and behave and excel at school.
Hmm.
Since John was not spending much time with his father, Alma would take it upon herself to bring him to her community functions, which mostly included events at the church. John Sr., on top of running a local store, was also a church trustee and its treasurer, and Alma would quickly begin to encourage John Jr. to follow in his father's footsteps.
Hmm.
All about religion.
Yeah, but at the same time, why would he want to follow in his father's footsteps when his father doesn't want to include him in anything?
Right, I think that was Alma's way of, like, maybe trying to get them to form a better relationship.
That makes sense. She's trying to encourage John Jr. to do something that John Sr. enjoys.
Right.
To kind of create that bond.
Yeah.
Synthetically.
Alma would also take it upon herself to spend more quality time with John Jr. each night at bedtime, and the two would read the Bible together most nights. You made a face like, oh,
oh no. Well, this is a crime
podcast.
I didn't know where this was going.
Alma was noted as being a bit of a worried mother, especially since John was her only child. She would constantly be worried that her son would get sick, and because of this, she would watch him constantly and keep him dressed up in order to stay warm and dry.
She's a little helicoptery?
Yeah, very much so. Alma would also tell John that the outside world was scary and dangerous, and she would not permit him to go play with any other neighborhood children or even, like, play outside by himself.
I'm gonna say it again. That's not gonna affect him later.
Yeah, right? A lot of these things we're seeing.
Oh, no.
John, having a good relationship with his mother and a poor one with his father, abided by Alma's wishes and accepted that he would just be staying home. Once John reached high school, he had a little bit of luck making some friends, but he found himself having trouble making any romantic connections with girls.
Well, his mother's number one.
Right, exactly. She's probably like, don't date girls, they're the devil.
They're the devil, you know? They're the devil. Little girls are the devil.
John would blend into the background throughout his time at Bay City Central High School, and he would ultimately graduate in the year 1943. The same year he graduated high school, John would enlist himself in the United States Army to serve as a laboratory technician during World War II. Of course, Alma was totally against this, but John would find himself disobeying his mother for one of the first times, and he would go anyway.
Hmm.
The following year, in 1944, John Sr. would die, and John Jr. would head home from the Army in order to attend his funeral. During the funeral service, it was noted by several attendees that John was seemingly unbothered by his father's death. He was emotionless and showed no signs of grief, seeming unaffected by the death of his father.
He never had an emotional connection to him.
Right, so why would he?
Yeah.
But again, at this time in history, I'm pretty sure, I mean, I feel like it would be a little odd, like, it's the nuclear family. Like, you should be distraught that your father's dead. I don't care right. What kind of relationship you had with it, you know?
That's true. It is a very different generation, and parents were completely different than the way they are now.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's just a father's role at that time could be seen as someone who's a disciplinarian,
mm-hmm.
someone who keeps the family in line.
Yeah.
And maybe not everyone did have an emotional connection with their father back then.
But they probably had to pretend.
They probably had to pretend anyways.
Following the funeral, John would return to the Army, where he would serve for another 2 years before being discharged in 1946. Although he was there for nearly 3 years, John did not get to see much combat, as the war was over pretty quickly after he enlisted.
Hmm.
However, he would come home with a keen interest in firearms and a new weapon of his own, an Austrian Steyr pistol. He got to keep it, I guess.
Wow.
Or maybe he bought it when he was, you know, overseas.
Or he stole it off of somebody's body.
Well, you know. Speculation.
Tomato, tomato.
Once John was home, Alma would quickly take it upon herself to encourage John to go to school for accounting, as it could turn into a really good career for him. John would agree and would make the decision to go to college, where he would enroll at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. While he was here, Alma would frequently visit John, and the two would go to dinner and attend church services together, as well as studying the Bible. John would go on to earn a bachelor's degree in business administration. During this time, he would also be recognized as a second lieutenant through his participation in the ROTC.
Hmm.
Furthering his education even more, John would quickly enroll in his graduate program and achieve his master's degree in accounting.
Rifle Paper Company is known for their high-quality, handmade designs that are sure to brighten and lighten up every room in your home. Rifle Paper has been creating one-of-a-kind designs since 2009. From stationery to decor, find your favorite design and shop from there. My favorite design is Bramble. I can get this design in duvets, tumblers, an ottoman, and even wallpaper. Nathan and Anna Bond are a husband and wife team, and they are the brilliant minds behind Rifle Paper Company, which is fueled by local Florida printers. Click the link in the show notes to receive an exclusive offer today. Rifle Paper Company, quality products that bring beauty into the everyday.
Just as he was getting ready to begin a career in the field, John would be called into service for the Korean War in November of 1950.
This is like, okay, so his mother is the one that said, she didn't agree with him going into the military, but when he came back, she was like, oh, you should do this business thing. And he's like, okay. And then he just did it for so long. And I feel like this is going to come back around. I feel like this is going to be, he leaves and it's going to be an I told you so situation okay, just tell me.
But at the same time, during this time when he's going back to the war, like now it's not his choice. Like he was called because
right.
The war was starting and they're like, we need you. I don't know if at that point there was a draft for the Korean War or if it was because he was, veteran.
Yeah.
So they were like, we just need you.
Right. But either way, if he hadn't been defiant, he wouldn't be called.
That's true, yeah.
Is what I'm saying.
Yeah, at the beginning, yeah.
Yes.
During this stint in the military, similarly to his first experience, John would not see much combat, and he would be stationed at Fort Eustis in Virginia. Here, John would meet a woman by the name of Helen Morris Taylor. Helen was the widow of an infantry officer that had been killed in action in Korea, and she lived nearby the base with her 9-year-old daughter, Brenda. Hmm. One night, while out for a bowling excursion, John would meet Helen, who was there with her sister, Jean. John would strike up conversation with Helen, and she would notice that, while he seemed like a bit of a mama's boy, he was kind and stable. John and Helen would quickly get acquainted and begin dating, an arrangement that Alma did not care for one bit. Shocker.
Right.
Alma was noted as being suspicious of Helen because she did not belong to their church. Alma also noted that Helen had endured multiple miscarriages at the young age of 24, and she was concerned that she would not be able to bear John a child, and Alma a grandchild.
But, I mean, she has a child. Right. So, she has a child.
Exactly.
Like, don't forget about that child. Mm-hmm. That child also still needs the nuclear family.
Right,
there,
exactly.
Alma, okay?
However, quickly after they began seeing each other, Helen would announce that she was pregnant. Due to this news, Helen and John would quickly get married, just 2 months after meeting on December 1st, 1951.
My, that is quick.
That is quick. Following their marriage, Alma would take any opportunity to tell John that he had made a mistake and married down, which is rude.
That is so rude. It's still your daughter-in-law. You're not going to make any attempt?
No. Shortly after the marriage, Helen would admit to John that she was not actually pregnant. And Helen would quickly realize that she might have married John a little too soon after meeting Alma. She's like, ooh, I don't know if I like this
woman.
Oh,
man, can't get along with the mother-in-law? Divorce.
Yeah. Around this time, the Army would reassign John to the Finance Corps due to his accounting education. And John would invite his mother to move in with the family as she had never been to California before.
Well, that's a great idea. Yeah, just move her in.
So they all moved to California.
Oh, my gosh.
So John, his wife, the daughter, and the mom.
Yes.
Once they were in California, Helen began to truly see the domineering person that Alma was, and the two would very quickly begin butting heads. On top of this, John would constantly find himself caught in between his wife and his mother.
Oh, no.
Till his oldest time.
Till his oldest time.
John would officially be discharged from the Army in 1952, and he would shortly thereafter find work at an accounting firm in Detroit. He would move the family with him and begin working at the prestigious firm. Helen, Alma's with him as well.
Mm.
A few years into this job and still living in Detroit, Helen would become pregnant with her and John's first child, and Patricia Marie would be welcomed to the world in January of 1955.
For real this time?
Yes. The birth of their first child would seemingly change Alma's mind about Helen, and she would be awestruck with love for this child.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, you're fine now in my book, because you gave me a grandchild.
Because now I have a grandbaby.
Around this time, John would take a different job, this time in Kalamazoo, Michigan, as an audit supervisor at a paper company. Helen and John's second child, John Frederick, would be born in 1956 while here in Kalamazoo. The family moved yet again. Meanwhile, Helen was growing tired of having to attend church services with John and his mother when she was really not interested in his religion. Helen would begin avoiding church, and this would leave John feeling abandoned and upset.
Hmm.
In response to this, John would begin to withdraw and spend more time in private. This would go on for nearly 2 years, until 1958, when Helen would become pregnant yet again. Helen would be experiencing intense depression around this time, and her pregnancy hormones would not help this. And keep in mind, she had a baby, like, within a year, and now it's within 2 years. Like,
yeah.
She's probably not given herself enough time to recover
right. Hormonally.
Not that it's her fault, but just
no,
in general.
Course. It can happen, yeah.
Also around this time, Brenda, Helen's first child, now 16, was beginning to cause trouble and begging to get out of the house. I'm sure she was like, this guy's not for me, I'm not a fan of his mom.
You know? And there's two little babies now screaming all the time in the house. Can't be fun.
That's true. John and Helen's third child, Frederick Michael, would be born, and shortly after this, Helen would begin drinking very heavily to cope with her depression.
Mm.
Helen's addiction would quickly take over, and soon she was turning to tranquilizers to cope with her feelings.
Tranquilizers?
Yeah.
Dang.
I'm like, do they even have those back then?
Yeah, horse tranquilizers, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's true. Helen would recognize that she needed help around this time, and she would begin to see a psychiatrist. However, she was still struggling with her addiction, and this would cause her to spend more money than she was making, and leaving John to be the main caretaker of the children, as she was neglecting them at this time as well.
That's so sad. Because it's really not sad. She's clearly doing it because of something she's going through, not because she's a party chick, you know?
And it kind of sounds like John is like, well, you're not interested in my religion, then I'm not interested in helping you. Like, you need to just turn to God. I'm sure he's saying that. Like, just turn to the church or whatever.
Just like his own father.
However, regardless of her extracurricular activities, Helen's, John was known as rarely complaining. On a couple of occasions, Helen was noted as pushing John a little too far, and he was noted as responding with rage and aggression. In one particular instance, during an argument, John was noted as overturning the kitchen table. In response to this, an aloof Helen simply stated that she was not going to pick anything up and left the room, leaving John to clean up his rage mess.
Well,
which he did.
I'd be like that too. I'd be like, okay, now you're gonna clean that up.
Yeah, now because, you broke that. Yeah. what good is that gonna do?
I understand what the picture is painting, which is that she is unbothered because of the amount of alcohol and just her lack of probably understanding at this point of really what's going on if she's numbing herself.
Yeah, definitely.
To extreme.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. By 1959, John had risen to general supervisor of the company's accounting department, but Helen's erratic behavior was also becoming increasingly unstable. Unbeknownst to John, Helen had also contracted syphilis in the past from her previous husband, a fact that she did not disclose to John when they got married. Hmm. This, coupled with her depression and substance abuse issues, caused Helen to experience extreme mental symptoms. A year later, in 1960, an 18-year-old Brenda would marry and leave the household. Meanwhile, the company that John was working for would merge, and he would take the opportunity to accept work in Rochester, New York, moving the family with him yet again.
That's a big move, though, especially if you're in finance.
Yeah, definitely.
That's great.
During the time he was working in New York, John and Helen's relationship would remain the same, but John would keep up the act in front of his coworkers that he had the perfect home life.
Of course.
Back at home, Helen would begin to despise John, and she would start to recognize the attention she would get from other men. Helen was not shy about this attention, and this would really upset John, straining their relationship even further.
So, is she going out? I guess she's going out at this point to drink?
I don't think, like, it wasn't, like, a specific instance that I heard, like, she was flirting with other men or, like, going out to meet other men. Mm-hmm. I think she was just starting to realize that, like, there was other men around her other than John.
Sure.
Like, she was distancing herself, like, oh, there might be something better out here for me, you know?
Like, at the coffee shop, she's noticing passing glances or something.
Yeah, something like that. It wasn't super specific.
Yeah.
Regardless of their differences, John and Helen would stay married, and John would also keep this position in New York until 1965. Around this time, John accepted yet another different position as vice president and comptroller at a bank in Jersey City, New Jersey. So the List family would up and move once again.
Hmm.
This time to a 19-room Victorian mansion.
Wow.
19-room.
What do you do with those 19 rooms?
What do you need? You need like 15 more kids.
Yeah. Exactly. You don't have the children for that.
Yeah.
You just start adopting some.
But Victorian mansion, that's where John grew up, but they lived in the apartment at the top. So he's like, I'm gonna buy the whole damn house.
Full circle.
Yeah.
Wow.
However, while John's job was good, it was not that good, and he would enlist the help of his mother to cover the down payment on the house.
Okay, I don't like this whole, like, Norman Bates thing. It's wild to
me. Yeah, she's coming too.
Because now they own a mansion.
Yeah.
And it's very Norman Bates. Very Norman Bates. Also, it seems like he kind of doesn't stay in a position for very long, does he? Is it that he's moving up, or is it just... You think he gets bored?
I think it's a little bit of both, and also, it kind of comes out later that he doesn't really have great, like, social skills and, like, great relationships with coworkers.
I see.
So I think maybe he's like, ugh, I'm just over this, and I just want to move somewhere else. But he's also, in turn, like, gaining better positions and moving up in the chain, if you will.
Well, I guess, especially back then, if you have a lot of experience equals, to some extent... almost kind of like a degree at certain points in time.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's also something to consider. Yeah, that's interesting. So you think it's more like coworkers that are saying, well, you dropped a piece of paper, and he's like, so-and-so is just,
yeah, you know, I think unbearable. He just, like, is kind of, like, he doesn't like to stay in the same place very often. He wants the next best thing.
Yeah.
So, again, he would enlist the help of his mom to cover the down payment on the home. Alma would agree on one condition. She'd be allowed to live in the home as well. I mean, they got 19 rooms. It's not like they don't have space.
Yeah, put her in the mother-in-law suite in the backyard.
Yep. She was actually in the upstairs apartment.
Oh, okay.
Where they lived when he was a kid. So he gave her that whole upstairs apartment. She lived there by herself. It was like three stories up.
It was the same house?
No. The same, like, setup.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, my gosh. I was like, whoa. Really full circle.
Right. This new job of John's would not last long due to the fact that it required social skills that he didn't have and the ability to pull in business that John couldn't do. He didn't really have any, like, sales bone in his body. Mm. Furthermore, his colleagues around this time would describe John as extremely cold and altogether unlikable, which is, like, great. That's, like, a really bad thing to say.
So mean.
So within the first year, John would be let go from this position. Living in a very nice home, John would quickly find himself struggling to pay the mortgage and utility bills, especially on top of the already expensive bills to take care of his family.
Yeah.
I mean, they have four kids. Well, one's out of the house, but, you know, three kids.
Three kids and a mother-in-law.
Yeah. John decided that he was going to keep his firing to himself, and he would continue to get up each morning and leave the home, leaving Helen to believe he was going to work every day.
He did not. Yeah. That's foul.
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
Because that's, like, one of the dumbest things I've ever heard in my life.
That's wild to just lie to someone about what you did with your day.
Yeah.
Just put on your uniform and just straight up lie about your day.
It's just, like, it's weird to me because it's, like, I mean, okay, in this instance, I'm not going to say it makes sense, but he's, like, trying to feign that he has money, right? But also, like, how are you going to actually get money? Like, you can only pretend that you're going to work for so long, and then she's going to be like, well, where's the bills? You know what I mean? Like, where's the mortgage?
Does he become a paperboy? I don't understand. He's got to get a job.
Yeah.
So, I mean, part of that is, you're not only are you just lying to your family the entire time, but you have no concept of future consequences.
Exactly, yeah.
You went and started living out of your means and bought this giant house, and now, you know, you didn't plan for the future, bro.
Yep. However, when John left the home, he was actually going to the train station, and he would just sit there all day reading a book or the newspaper.
He gets on the train, leaves, and we never see him again.
Yeah. Bye, sayonara.
He dicks over Helen with the mortgage is what he does.
That's on you, girl. I didn't put my name on the lease.
I am out of here.
John would keep up this charade for a full 6 months, paying the bills from his mother's bank account.
Does his mother know?
Since Alma had moved into the home and was getting older, John had actually taken over as her financial power of attorney.
Oh my God.
However, he was not telling her how she stood financially, and he was using all of her money without her knowledge.
He's like, everything's great.
It's all good.
Why are you crying?
I'm making so much money at work.
Why are you crying, John? Oh,
yeah.
Everything's fine. Everything's the life that I wanted.
Oh, horrible.
That's sad.
John would eventually find another job to commute to in New York, but again, this would only last for a year. John would finally accept his financial state and take out a second mortgage to pay his bills.
Oh, that'll fix it.
Yeah. At around this time, in the late 60s, Helen would be diagnosed with cerebral atrophy, a degenerative brain disorder, and John would be advised to institutionalize her so that she could have better assistance.
Wow, that's so sad.
It's probably due to the substance abuse, I would think.
Yeah.
John would refuse to do this, and he would just keep Helen at the mansion. He's like, no, we're not doing that. But he didn't, like, get any external help.
So he was like, I'm just going to...
She's fine.
She's a shut-in now.
Yeah. In an attempt to escape his reality, John began to throw himself into his hobbies. He would read books on crime, the military, and weapons. Probably at the train station. Hmm. It was around this time that John was noted as suggesting to his brother-in-law that it would be really easy for him to just begin another life and start over. He's like, you know what? Screw this. Like, I could just start over. I could just disappear.
He is going to hop on that train and never come back.
I know you said that. I thought that was funny. John would get yet another job around this time, where he would sell mutual funds from his home, and Helen would continue to drink heavily. As for Helen and John, while John was still attending church services and overall kind of well-adjusted, he and Helen were arguing frequently. John would try and buy things for Helen to appease her, but this never seemed to work. On top of this, John would begin sleeping in a separate bedroom altogether to avoid Helen's harsh language and lashouts. John would lean towards his faith and begin praying for the Lord to guide him in his current situation and give him a sort of sign, but he never received one. Being that it was the 60s, John was still under pressure to be the man of the household and provide for his family. On top of this, the nuclear family was expected to be happy and intact, and John was embarrassed and ashamed that this was simply not the case in his household.
Yeah.
John began to resent his life and thinking that he was a failure as a man. To counteract this, John would take to the children, beginning to rule over them with an iron fist and forcing them to obey his rules that they believed were unfair. He's like, okay, if I can't control my wife or my mom, I'm going to control the kids. At least they'll listen to me.
Yeah. And we can all look like at least a few of us look happy.
Yeah. From the outside, however, John was just a strict religious father who mowed his lawn in a suit and tie.
No, he did not.
I swear.
No, he did not.
Yes.
Is there a photo?
No, I don't know. Actually, I haven't looked.
I need receipts.
It's receipts or it didn't happen. The couple's eldest child, Patricia, or Patty, would begin to rebel around this point. Patty would be picked up by the police for walking in the streets after midnight and smoking. Furthermore, she had expressed desires to become an actress to her parents, and John would respond to this by calling her a slut, and was very clearly jealous that she had friends and a social life outside of the home.
Interesting.
He's like, no, you slut. Like, don't have friends.
You want to be an actress. Yeah. You know one other person. You must be a slut.
Yeah. Furthermore, unbeknownst to John, his young teen daughter had begun to experiment with drugs and developed a keen interest in the occult. It was around this time that Patty would begin to distance herself from her father, as she thought that he just didn't care for her. In October of 1971, John was noted as applying for a firearms registration he noted as being for, quote, home protection, end quote. He does have a keen interest in guns.
Sure.
On November 5th, 1971, John and his family sat down for their nightly dinner at home. Following dinner, John grabbed all three of his children and sat them down. John told his children that they must prepare to die, before asking them if they wanted to be buried or cremated after their deaths.
What?
While the children were in shock, they also either thought their father was just being morbid or didn't want to upset him, and they would all answer that they would rather be buried. It became clear quickly that the children were having a difficult time with this comment by their father, and Patty would even take it upon herself to confide in her drama coach.
This is wild.
She would tell him that if he were to hear that her family were going on vacation anytime soon, this would really mean that her father was about to murder the children.
Oh my gosh, heebs.
I literally got all of them.
Oh my gosh.
All the heebs. The drama teacher would not take this comment seriously and just brush it off.
No.
Sorry. We've heard that so many times.
Yeah, don't do that.
On November 9th, 1971, John would write up a note and place it on the front door. The note stated something along the lines of letting the milkman, newspaper guy, and mailman know not to drop anything off at the home that day. However, when the milkman showed up at the home, he would walk up to the door, read the note, and be on his way. On top of this note, John had also mailed himself a letter that contained a key to his filing cabinet. In the morning, John would send the children to school, watch the milkman leave the home, and begin what would be a heinous attack. Helen would be the first one to walk down the stairs and into the kitchen to make herself something to eat. John was in the office on the first floor, and upon hearing Helen enter the kitchen, he would exit the office and sneak up behind her as she sat looking out the window. John would raise his 1912 Steyr 9mm that he got in the army up to Helen's head, pull the trigger, and shoot her in the jaw.
Oh my God.
Helen fell forward towards the table, hitting it on her way to the floor, and died almost instantly.
Oh my God.
It was noted that Helen had part of the toast she was eating still in her throat when she died, and this has led investigators to believe that she might have seen John coming or heard him right before he shot her.
That's savage.
Following Helen being deceased, John fired several more rounds of shots into the wall behind the table. I'm not sure about the reason for this.
Well, maybe because... maybe he was trying to stage it as an attack or self-defense. So if it's like, oh, I just shot her in self-defense once, it doesn't really look, you know.
John's mother, Alma, was at home during this time, but she lived on the third floor of the mansion in her own apartment. John would make his way up three flights of stairs and reach the apartment. John Wood opened the door without knocking and surprised his mother, who was in the kitchen making breakfast. Alma was awaiting her own toast to be ready, and when John barged in, she asked him what all the noise was that she had just heard downstairs. John would not respond to his mother, and instead immediately shoot her point blank in her left eye, then shot twice more into the wall behind her.
Wow.
Another source stated that John may have missed his mother the first time, which is why he shot again, but he did hit her at least once and killed her.
Mm.
John was originally planning on taking his mother downstairs, but she was too heavy for him to lift, so he would ultimately push her body onto a carpet runner and drag her into a nearby closet. Following this, John would head back downstairs and move Helen's body into a downstairs bathroom. The movement of Helen's deceased body was noted as leaving a 40-foot trail of blood.
Oh my god, that is, yeah. That is so, not just the visualization of it, but it's cruel.
Yeah,
like
oh
you
yeah.
Very much intended to do what you were doing.
Right. John then took three sleeping bags and opened two of them up next to each other and placed Helen's body on the third. John would cover her body with a bath towel, also placing a kitchen towel on her head. John would do his best to clean up the blood from both murders, and at this point, he realized that his own clothes were soaked in blood. John made his way into Helen's bedroom, which he was not staying in at the moment, and sat down on her bed, wiping his hands off on the blanket. He then ran into the bathroom and vomited, leaving a bloody handprint on the toilet lid. Following this, John would shower and change into a suit and tie, leaving his soiled clothes and shoes in the bathroom. He would then call his boss to leave him a message that he would not be able to attend the scheduled meeting he had with him. He explained that he was going to be taking his family to North Carolina to see Helen's mother, who was very ill.
Dang, the daughter called it.
Yep. Helen's mother was indeed ill at this time, but she was actually planning on being with the Lists that week on a trip. Due to her being sick, she couldn't make it, and this may have prevented her from becoming a victim as well. John would then write notes to the children's schools and places of employment with the same message. John would hang out at the home doing casual chores for many hours as he awaited the children's return from school. He then went out in his yard, in his suit and tie, to rake leaves.
What? There's no way this man does this.
Well, that's what it says. A neighbor of his saw him, but John pretended not to see her. He would then go back inside and make some lunch for himself.
Lunch? I'm sorry, lunch?
Just casual Sammy and chips.
Yep. When his wife and mother lay dead in that house.
Right. Then the phone rang. It was Patty. She had called the family home stating that she was not feeling well and wanted John to come pick her up from school so that she could come home.
Oh no.
A slightly annoyed John would agree and go pick up his daughter. He was slightly annoyed because this wasn't part of his plan.
Right. And he's slightly annoyed because anything that has to do with his children.
Yeah.
And like you said, he has very methodically planned this out. This was not part of the plan to bring her home early. You're right.
But that makes me think, like, she wasn't feeling well. I wonder if she had, like, a gut feeling. Like, she thought that was after her mom and grandmother had been killed.
Yeah.
You know how some people have that intuition?
Yeah, when Ma died, I had woken up. I was actually at a friend's house. I had snuck out at age 15, 16 years old. I had done this regularly where I went over to a friend's house and played video games, and all of a sudden I started feeling like really sick at like 2:30 in the morning, maybe 3. So I asked him if he could drive me home, and it was literally within 30, 40 minutes of that our mother got a phone call that our grandmother had passed away.
Yeah.
Wild.
So again, John went to pick up Patty from school, and once the two were back home, John would hurry past Patty and into the home. Once inside, he crouched behind a door and waited for his daughter to enter.
Oh my god, this is awful.
As Patty entered the home, John would jump up and shoot her at close range in the back of her head. Patty would fall forward and die as she hit the floor. John then dragged her body and placed it into one of the open sleeping bags. After cleaning himself up once again, John went out to run some errands.
Oh my, this man. If you can call him that.
Yeah. This included gathering up however much money he was able to get and mailing the letters that he had written. He would run into some people around town that he knew while he was out, and these people would later state that his face was red and blotchy, and he seemed kind of nervous, but they just kind of brushed it off.
Red and blotchy, like blood?
I don't know. I feel like it's a little bit of, like, embarrassment, kind of like...
Nerves.
Like, flush, you know, like, kind of like, ugh. But yeah, maybe blood.
Like, he knows he's creating an alibi. An alibi.
Yeah. Later that afternoon, John would go pick up his youngest son, Fred, from his after-school job. Once again, he would hurry into the house before his son and await him entering the home.
This is brutal.
Fred did not even have time to remove his coat before being shot in the head once, instantly dying. John would take Fred's body and place it beside his mother's. The remaining child, John Jr., was at soccer practice at this time, and he was not expected home until later. From this point on, I'm going to refer to John as John Sr. and then his son as John Jr. Mm-hmm. John Sr. would get ready to leave to pick up his son, but as he was exiting the home, he saw John Jr. coming up the driveway, arriving home much earlier than anticipated.
Not part of his plan.
John Sr. would quickly go back inside and hide. John Jr. would enter the home through the laundry room and come upon his father pointing a gun at him. John Jr. would reach forward and grab his father's hand, the gun being shot in the process. The bullet would go into the ceiling, and the two began struggling over the gun. Two more shots would be fired into the floor, another would hit the cabinet, and a fifth would hit the dining room window frame. John Jr. would continue to dodge any shots fired at him. However, as he was trying to get away, a bullet would be fired into his back, then another on the back of his neck, and a third would hit him in the head. John Jr. would fall to the floor, breaking his jaw in the process. John Sr. would fire once again at his son, but the boy was still alive at this point.
Oh my god, this is so terrible.
John Sr. would grab a second gun at this point and begin firing multiple rounds, not even caring about the amount of noise he was making. As he was continuing to be shot at, John Jr. would begin crawling across the floor in order to avoid the bullets. He would turn himself over at one point, and he was met with another shot straight to his eye. Still, John Jr. was alive, and his father would shoot him once again. All in all, John Jr. would suffer 10 bullet wounds and would ultimately die at the scene.
Oh my god. That poor kid. Mm-hmm. Just, I mean, horrendous. That's, last few moments.
Yeah. Like, he did everything he possibly could.
This is your father.
And he's, the father is like, I'm gonna stop at nothing to kill you. Like,
just bloodlust.
John would drag his eldest son into the area where the other family members were and covered each one of their faces with towels. He would then kneel down and pray over their bodies, willing their souls to be at peace. Yeah, okay.
Okay, yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah. As John was getting ready to leave the home, the doorbell rang. It was the mailman coming to deliver the letter that John had mailed to himself.
What?
He went into town to mail it, but he lives down the street. So the mailman's like, oh, this is right here. Let's bring it back.
What?
Getting no answer, the mailman would slip the letter into the door and be on his way. Still at the home, that evening, John would call his pastor, Reverend Rewinkle, and relate to him the plans to head to North Carolina with the family. He also stated that, because he was going to be out of town, he would not be able to teach Sunday school that weekend like he had planned.
Oh, he's such a good guy.
Then, John called Patty's drama coach and told him the plan to leave town. At this point, John would sit down at the table and begin to write another letter. This time, it was to his pastor. The letter was entitled, quote, A Few Words from John E. List, Career Builder, end quote. I couldn't find the whole note, but I will relay the pieces that I found. Quote, Dear Pastor Rewinkle, I am very sorry to add this additional burden to your work, end quote. After explaining what he had done, John stated other things such as, quote, I leave myself in the hands of God's justice and mercy. This makes me think that perhaps it was for the best as far as the children's souls are concerned. After it was all over, I said some prayers for them all from the hymn book. That was the least I could do. I know that many will only look at the additional years that they could have lived, but if I finally, there were no longer Christians, what would be gained? I think that was a misinterpreted when it was
mistranslated. Yeah.
Quote, also, I'm sure many will say, how could anyone do such a horrible thing? My only answer is, it isn't easy and was only done after much thought, end quote.
So he's not doing a self-defense angle like I said.
Yeah. He's not like, they're going to heaven.
Yeah. I did this for their souls, which is really interesting because...
Reminds me of Andrea Yates.
Exactly. A lot. Yeah, Andrea Yates, who, you know, committed the act of killing her children because she thought that she was saving their souls.
Yeah.
We haven't, other than John's association with the church, we really haven't seen him kind of geared towards this kind of religious fanatic.
Yeah, but I think it went a lot deeper than, like, what it says. And, you know, him and his mom had that relationship with, you know, their religion. His parents were really devoutly religious. They wanted him to follow in the footsteps of their community work with the church. I think that he might have been way more involved in it than we are seeing from the research.
It's maybe a sense of identity.
Yeah. Looking for a new perfume or cologne to match your style? Scentbird has got you covered. With over 600 scents to fall in love with, Scentbird is a fragrance subscription box that will give you plenty of choices. Just choose what you would like from their best sellers, activate your subscription, and receive your first 120 spray bottle. Click the link in the show notes now to receive an exclusive offer with Scentbird. John would continue in the note and state that he shot his family members from behind because he, quote, didn't want any of them to know, even at the last second, that I had to do this to them, end quote.
But your son.
Yeah. He then stated about having to also kill his mother because it, quote, would have been a tremendous shock to her, end quote.
I could see that. Like, it would kill her anyways.
Yeah, or she would have turned him in, probably. John finishes the letter by talking about how he was upset that Helen stopped going to church and the fact that she had talked about leaving the church altogether. He stated about this, quote, "If any one of these had been the condition, we might have pulled through this, but it was just too much. At least I'm certain that all have gone to heaven now," end quote. He signed the letter, John, and then included, quote, "P.S. Mother is in the hallway in the attic, third floor. She was too heavy to move," end quote.
Oh, my heaves.
If the rest of the letter didn't, like, make you convinced that he's just, like, cold-blooded, that tells me, I'm like, okay, like, that was super nonchalant. Like, yeah. By the way,
in case you're looking for her.
Yeah.
Which you might be, because you walked in upon this scene.
Yeah, just letting you know.
Just letting you know. If you choose.
Yeah.
She's upstairs in the closet.
Right. It's like, okay, thanks for that freaking information.
Great.
Among other things, in the 5-page letter, John had asked that his family be buried altogether, and he felt sure that God would forgive him. After writing this letter, John would make himself dinner and lay down to take a little nap.
In the house?
Mm-hmm. He would sleep for hours, and he woke up around dusk, like right when the sun was setting.
I mean, I guess it's a big enough house.
Yeah.
But still.
Upon waking up, John would set the thermostat to 50 degrees, turned on every single light in the rooms of the home, and put music on over the intercom speakers. I think it was classical.
Hmm.
John would pack up some essentials and leave the home, but not before cutting himself out of all the family photos in the home.
What?
I don't know if that was, like, he's doing that to himself as, like, a way to, like, I'm cutting myself out of their lives because I did this, or he was trying to cover his tracks, maybe, and he didn't want photos of him in the house because it would be harder to determine, like, who it was that they were looking for.
Hmm.
I don't know what that came from.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting theory, that they wouldn't be able to identify specifically who he was, and...
Or circulate multiple different photos of him. You
of
know,
him, with the, yeah. Exactly. It would just have to be on, essentially, eyewitness testimony from friends and family.
Yeah. Also, that letter that he wrote, he left at the house as well, for the police to find. Hmm. Well, he was wanting the pastor to be the only one to see it, but yes. He left it at the house. He didn't mail it like he did everything else.
But the mailman dropped off the house key?
He had a key to a filing cabinet that he mailed to himself. I didn't read anything else about that.
Oh.
I don't know why he did that. I couldn't find out. I mean, I probably could have, like, dug a little deeper to find out, but it didn't, like, pan out to anything.
Interesting.
Maybe it was a filing cabinet elsewhere, like, at his office or something that he needed.
Fair.
So John left the house and planned on starting a new life, like he said would be so easy to do.
I just don't understand. You murder your entire family because you were trying to save them from a religious standpoint?
Mm-hmm.
Or you felt like you had no other choice? Or was it to start a new life? Because I feel like this is all conflicting emotions.
Yeah, and he was saying, well, you know, he was saying with his, I think in his mind, like, my financial burdens, like, this is too much. Like, I can't keep up this lifestyle anymore.
Mm.
They're going to suffer anyway. Not excusing it. I'm just thinking what he might have been thinking.
Right.
But yeah, so he hopped a train, and that's the end of the story.
You're funny.
Patty's drama coach, becoming worried that what Patty said may have actually happened, would drive past the home later that evening, but seeing all the lights on, he figured everything was fine, and he went home.
Fair. That's probably why he did it, but yeah. Fair.
With all of the people in their lives thinking that they just left town for a while, nobody really thought anything was wrong with the List family. In fact, weeks would go by with nobody being the wiser that there were several bodies in the List home.
Oh my god.
And it would not be until the church, schools, and extended family members got weary that there would be any question as to what had happened. It wasn't until neighbors noticed no change in the home for a while, and the drama teacher bugged officials enough that they phoned police to do a wellness check. When police arrived on December 7th, 1971, nearly a month after the murders, they were horrified by what they discovered.
Yeah, I bet.
Nearly a month almost to the day, like 2 days shy of a month.
I will say, he did turn down the thermostat, which is interesting.
Well, he probably wanted to maintain the crime scene so that it didn't, sorry to be gross, but smell and right. Alert neighbors.
Exactly. Preserved them.
Yeah. News quickly spread about the most violent crime that the town had ever seen, and a nationwide manhunt was quickly put into place. Once the letter had surfaced, and it was clear that John was the main suspect in the case, officers began to believe that he would eventually turn himself in.
Yeah, right.
Meanwhile, investigators were able to come up with at least 150 pieces of incriminating evidence from the crime scene to use against John once he was in custody.
But not a single photo of him.
Yeah. They would attend the funeral services for the family, hoping that John would show up, but with no luck. The FBI would also quickly get involved with the case, and they would put up wanted signs around the area with John's photo and description. On top of these photos and info, police were also able to determine that John suffered from severe hemorrhoids and had really bad eyesight, facts that they were not shy about sharing.
Like, this guy, if you see this man's butthole, he has hemorrhoids.
The flyers were also sent to pharmacies and eye doctors all over the country. Whoa. With the hope that he would seek help from one of them along the way. Isn't that so smart,
though? That is smart.
That's so smart. That's this guy doesn't have glasses and he can't see. He might come to you for help.
That's true. Although his name isn't John anymore, apparently.
Yeah, he's bleeding from the beehole. He might need some help.
It smells like poop and blood.
As investigators began to look further into John's life, they discovered that he had rented a private P.O. box to receive pornography subscriptions.
The devil of us all, right? Pornography.
Pretty soon it became clear to authorities that not only did John have a secret life, but he was not going to be easy to find. Meanwhile, after John left the home, he had traveled by train from New Jersey to Michigan and then to Colorado. Then, in the beginning of 1972, a man by the name of Robert or Bob Peter Clark would find work in the form of a night shift cook in Denver, Colorado, at a Holiday Inn.
Denver.
9 long months went by without any information leading to John, but on August 30th, 1972, the Victorian mansion where the murders happened burned to the ground.
Bum, bum, bum.
While there were many kids in and out of the home to vandalize it after the crimes, the cause of this fire was indeed arson. However, this crime would never be solved due to insufficient evidence, and a new house would be built on the property in 1974.
Interesting.
Back to 1972, so this is about a year after the murders, John would be proposed as a possible suspect in the D.B. Cooper air piracy.
No way!
Due to the fact that he disappeared 2 weeks prior to the airline hijacking, and he shared multiple characteristics with the hijacker's description.
He had a hat and glasses on.
Yeah, it didn't pan out.
Sunglasses.
Back in Colorado, Bob Clark had transitioned from line cook to a place called The Pinery and would quickly become assistant manager and accountant.
Oh, wow, that sounds familiar.
Bob would be successful in this company for a number of years, and in 1975, he would join a local church looking for a good community to involve himself in.
Interesting. Possibly looking for a wife.
Again, this is 4 years after the murders.
Oh my gosh.
The following year, a once-broke, lonely Bob Clark was now finding himself being able to afford a car and finally got a driver's license he had been wanting for years.
Hmm.
Now, with a vehicle, Bob would volunteer to drive members of his church where they needed to go and would even become part of the church's finance council.
Wow, you're telling me Bob knows things about finances?
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
That's so wild. This is the first time I'm hearing of this.
Yeah. Bob would meet a divorcee by the name of Dolores Miller around the late 70s at a singles social.
Oh.
In order to appease to her likings, Bob would agree to take square dancing lessons and treated Dolores very well. When Dolores inquired as to Bob's past relationships, he would share with her that he was a widower since his wife had died of cancer, but he never showed her a photo of his wife as it was a really sore subject for him. The two would date for a number of years, and they would tie the knot in 1985, 14 years after the murders. Shortly after the marriage, Bob would be fired from his job for failing to keep up with company changes, and he was also asked to leave his role as a Sunday school teacher due to his domineering approach.
Interesting. Was this after he purchased a 20-room mansion?
I don't think he did that yet.
Okay. He can't not, though. It's right? In his nature.
On top of this, Bob would attempt to become an independent financial consultant, but this would also fall through. At the age of 55, Bob was having trouble finding work, and Dolores would begin to regret sharing her life with him as he was beginning to be unsuccessful.
Interesting.
Around this time, while Bob was spending a lot of time at home, he began having frequent conversations with his neighbor, Wanda Flannery. Wanda was known as being very interested in tabloids and would come home with several a week for entertainment. One day, in February of 1987, Wanda came home with a new edition and spotted an article about a man named John List who had murdered his entire family 16 years prior and had gotten away with it. Immediately, Wanda noticed that this man looked remarkably similar to her neighbor, Bob.
Oh, couldn't possibly be Bob, though.
As she was reading, she glanced up from the paper and looked towards her neighbor's home, where Bob was standing, looking back at her. I couldn't even say it. Oh my god.
Stop.
I literally couldn't even say that without, like, oh, that's so creepy.
He was staring at her through the window. I thought you were going to say he was mowing the lawn in a suit.
Just staring at her in a suit and tie.
In a suit and tie.
But yeah, I think, like, they were, the way that I read it, it made it seem like they were both, like, on their front porches. And she, like, just happened to look up and he's, like, just...
He knew he was in that magazine and he saw the cover.
He'd seen it. Like, he'd see his self from afar.
Does she know it's me?
As she kept reading, Wanda noticed that the little details that were included about John were the same as the little things about Bob. Bob had a scar from a procedure that John had had. They both had money problems and were very religious. They both worked in the same field of work and they were both from Michigan. Wanda began to wonder if she should tell Dolores about her suspicions, as she thought that surely Dolores knows things about Bob and would make it clear that he wasn't John.
Right.
She's like okay, she's going to tell me that I'm crazy.
I've met his family. I've met his mother. I've met his, you know, whatever. At least I know what the ex-wife looks like, you know? Yeah.
When Bob left the home for work at a temporary job one day, Wanda brought the paper over to Dolores' home, and she urged Dolores to show it to Bob in order to gauge his reaction. Dolores agreed that she would, but she ultimately would throw the paper away once Wanda left.
Well, who wants to do that? Are you this murderer?
Yeah.
Then you know that you're...
large murderer.
Like, at large murderer who's like not criminal. Afraid to murder his wife and most children. Wanted. Most wanted. Are you this man?
Are you most wanted?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That totally. That sounds like a smart decision.
So Wanda wouldn't push the issue following this. She didn't follow up. She's like, you know what? I told her. That's fine. Shortly after this, Bob would find work in Richmond, Virginia, and he and Dolores would pack up and move east.
Oh, gosh.
Meanwhile, the investigation was not really revealing anything new. At one point, there was a psychic that was brought in, and while there were certain things that would later make sense, it didn't really lead to much. In 1988, Fox would air a television show about fugitives from serious crimes that were still at large, entitled America's Most Wanted.
Yes, 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 yes. I love... John Walsh. Yes. I am obsessed. So for those who don't know, John Walsh's son, Adam, was actually kidnapped out of a grocery store when he was like six, I want to say. Five or six. And here in the States, we have something called a code Adam at our grocery stores, which means somebody calls a code Adam, you immediately lock the front doors. There is no in and out. Every person that works at the establishment is supposed to guard the doors until that child is found.
Right.
He was snatched out of a grocery store when his mother wasn't looking, and he was murdered.
Yeah, it's horrible. And then,
but John Walsh.
Yeah, John Walsh went on to become the host of America's Most Wanted.
Yes, he did. He does a lot of advocacy work.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah,
I'm hoping to meet him one day at CrimeCon.
That'd be incredible.
I think he was there this year.
That'd be an honor.
Yeah. Jeffrey Paul Hummel, the detective assigned to the case, had been working tirelessly until he got transferred to narcotics. He would still be asked to be updated on the case following his transfer, but he wouldn't really hear much, and as the years went on. One day, he would catch a glimpse of America's Most Wanted and reach out to Captain Frank Maronka in order to try to get the case on the show. When the case of John List was brought to the show, it was originally turned down as it was, quote, too old, end quote. Which is like, yeah, that's why. It's a cold case. Hello. Like, help us.
I think they did an Unsolved Mysteries on this one, too, didn't they?
Maybe. On this case?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not sure.
Probably around the time.
Yeah.
I think so.
However, the executive producer was scheduled to speak at a law enforcement conference, and Captain Maronka would go to the conference as well, taking the List files with him. He's like, okay, maybe I'll reach him here.
Mm-hmm.
The producer thought that the 17-year-old case was interesting and recognized that all of the potential witnesses were still alive.
Well, yeah, that would make for a great episode.
Mm-hmm. There was only one problem. Nobody had a recent photo of John.
Ooh.
The producer of America's Most Wanted actually knew a guy by the name of Frank Bender, who was a sculptor and photographer, and he was able to use clay to reconstruct what John's face must have looked like so many years later.
Wow.
Isn't that so cool that you can do that?
I love that. Yeah, that absolutely. This is before computer animation.
Right.
And, you know, of course, we have things like police sketch artists, but to really visualize what someone's face would look like 3D in clay, especially for the time, totally wild.
Yeah, impressive. On top of this, forensic psychologists were brought in to determine how John's personality may have developed or changed with age so that they could relay it. Like, he might be casual, he might be this, and then different than what they're saying he was like, you know, during the crimes.
Yeah, he might have a mustache, he might not, he might have glasses, he might not.
Right.
Is he bald? Is he not?
Right. The America's Most Wanted episode of John aired on May 21st, 1989, with John Walsh introducing the segment as New Jersey's most famous murder case.
Mm.
The story ran for just 10 minutes, with an estimated 22 million viewers.
Yeah. America's Most Wanted was hot at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody watched that every, whatever it was, Saturday night.
The funny thing is, Bob and Dolores would actually frequently watch the show themselves. But the night that it aired, they were at a church social, so they missed it.
This is before DVR.
Yeah, so he would have seen himself on the TV.
Could you imagine being Dolores?
Yeah.
Just being like,
Looks like you.
Not only were you in one article in a magazine, but now the entirety of America
is looking at you.
Someone who looks like you.
Yeah. Wanda Flannery was watching that night, however. But to her, the reconstructed sculpture didn't really resemble her old neighbor, Bob.
Hmm.
Regardless, she felt the need to come forward. She had her son-in-law call the phone number on the TV and gave them the info, along with Bob and Dolores' new address in Virginia.
Interesting.
On top of this, over 300 calls came into the hotline that evening. A lot of people were like, yo.
Check this guy out.
On June 1st, 1989, two FBI agents went to check out leads that they had received from the show. Bob and Dolores' home was first on the list. Agent Kevin August approached the door, knocked, and a woman would answer the door. Agent August simply stated the name Bob Clark in the form of a question, to which Dolores replied, he's at work.
She's over here hawkeyeing me.
The two agents would explain why they were there, and she would allow them to come in to show her some photos. Dolores was notably pale and began to tremble as she read the files. She admitted that there was some resemblance, but denied that it could be her husband. Then she began to cry, and as the conversation continued, the pieces became clear. Bob Clark was John List.
Hmm.
No one saw that one coming. One agent would stay at the home, while the other headed to Bob's place of work, phoning two other agents on the way. The agents entered the office and saw Bob Clark, who seemed unsurprised that they were there. They proceeded to ask Bob several questions about his identity, which he answered correctly, and then he was asked if he was John List, to which he responded, no. They noted that he responded so quickly, like he was expecting the question.
Right. Oh, are you John List? Nope. I'm not. Nope. Don't know who that is. Never heard of him before in my life.
Right, exactly. Yeah. The agents would begin searching Bob's person, and then they asked, quote, you're John List, aren't you? End quote. He told them once again that he was Robert Clark. He would be taken into custody without incident and allowed all of the booking processes such as fingerprinting, DNA, etc., whatever they had back then. Fingerprints were able to correctly identify the man as being John List, the perpetrator of 5 murders committed 18 years prior.
That's absolutely wild.
Imagine being those officers. You're like, oh my gosh, like, we actually got him.
Well, and then what luck that it happened to be the first place they checked out. Right. And, you know, thankfully they didn't just take Dolores's word for it and just be like, oh, is your husband John List? Yeah. No. Okay. Have a nice day, ma'am.
Or you, who knows, if he was there, he could have tried to attack them, like shoot them or, you know, harm them or flee or something. Right. It could have been deadly for a lot of people.
Well, and even her, you know, they leave her alone and then she confronts him later that night about his true identity. Yeah. And she ends up murdered.
Right. Throughout the trial, actually, Dolores would continue to insist that her husband was not John List. Like, even though she had seen all the evidence, she was still in denial.
Yeah. Well, nobody wants to believe that.
Right. John would plead not guilty on the charges of 5 counts of first-degree murder, and his bail would be set at $1 million while he awaited extradition to New Jersey.
Gosh, this guy got away with it for 18 years.
18 years.
You think you're scot-free for the rest of your life at that point.
I mean, shit, that's a long time.
It's a long time.
Surprisingly, John would agree to be extradited, but would not agree to be referred to as John List. He wanted to be called Robert Clark.
Okay.
By the end of June, Bob John was back in New Jersey for the first time since 1971.
Bob John.
His court-appointed attorney, Elijah Miller, argued that the compilation of John's financial issues, marital issues, problems with his mother and daughter, and more, were the factors that led him to doing what he thought was right. He further suggested that since Helen was already very sick, John thought he was going to give her mercy by allowing her soul to reach heaven. Obviously, not a really good defense, but pretty much all he has.
Not a great defense, and if it is just the mother, then why not his mother and the kids as well?
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Right. A court-appointed psychiatrist testified that John suffered from obsessive-compulsive personality disorder.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
You looking in a mirror? What you got going on in there, huh?
And due to this personality disorder, he only saw 2 solutions to his situation: accept welfare or kill his family.
Well, I mean,
he's not gonna accept charity.
That's beneath him. He owns a 19 room mansion,
and they thought that he essentially was too proud to accept welfare and admit that he was failing financially and needed some assistance.
Yeah.
So his solution was to just kill his family.
Again, we're looking at the lens of what year is this that he's caught?
No, 89.
We're looking at the lens of almost the 90s.
Yeah.
Not when he perpetrated the crime.
Exactly. Yeah.
If we were to look through the lens of when he perpetrated the crime, he would have gotten the electric chair. Nobody would have said, oh, it's because of this. It's because of a mental disorder. It's because of the pressure he felt. Nobody would have. No. He just would have been a monster.
That's true. I didn't even realize that OCPD has been around for that long as a diagnosis.
Yeah.
On April 12th, 1990, John List would be convicted of 5 counts of first-degree murder. At his sentencing, he denied responsibility for his actions, stating, quote, I feel that because of my mental state at the time, I was unaccountable for what happened. I ask all affected by this for their forgiveness, understanding their prayer, end quote. The judge would respond, quote, John Emil List is without remorse and without honor. After 18 years, 5 months, and 22 days, it is now time for the voices of Helen, Alma, Patricia, Frederick, and John F. List to rise from the grave. End quote.
Hell yeah.
I love when the judge, like, claps back.
Hell yeah.
The judge would then hand down 5 life sentences to be served consecutively. Helen's sister would also have a chance to confront John during the hearings, asking him why he did what he did. John responded, quote, because there was no other way, end quote.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, there was.
That's such a cop-out.
Yeah.
Literally, just pack a bag and leave.
Yeah.
If you're embarrassed.
It's silly. He didn't want the trail. Like, he didn't want to leave and then still have to, like, quote-unquote, deal with his family.
Yeah.
He wanted to just be scot-free and be like, oh, cool, I can start another life.
Yeah. Pay the child support, pay alimony, and then take care of an ailing mother.
Mm-hmm.
He's selfish.
John would file an appeal of his convictions on the grounds that his judgment had been impaired by PTSD from his military service.
Like, he gets it diagnosed and then all of a sudden it's like, that's his crutch.
Yeah.
Okay. But not all people who are diagnosed with this murder people. So
yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's not a, this isn't a loophole.
It's just not just, yeah, oh, sorry, I'm mentally ill. Like,
yeah.
No, that's not how it works.
Mm-hmm.
John also argued that the letter left behind at the scene, essentially his confession, was only supposed to be between him and the pastor, and that was confidential. So you couldn't, like, use that for evidence.
No, it's not. It's not confidential. When you murder someone,
and
it's
you
not...
left it in the open.
Yeah.
Both appeal requests were denied. In 2002, John List would eventually express a degree of remorse for his crimes, stating, quote, "I wish I had never done what I did. I've regretted my action and prayed for forgiveness ever since," end quote. When John was asked why he did not just take his own life rather than taking the lives of his whole family, he stated that he did not do so because that would be a mortal sin, and then he would not be able to go to heaven with his family.
Okay, that's...
Isn't murder a mortal sin?
Yeah.
Times five?
I don't... Yeah.
Right. On March 21st, 2008, John Emil List would die from complications from pneumonia at the age of 82.
Too good.
That's the whole story.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is a very entertaining case. Thank you for bringing that.
Yeah, absolutely. I started researching it, and I was like, I didn't really know much about it. And then as I was going through it, I was like, oh my gosh, like, I found so much really good information.
Yeah.
And I'm going to, of course, link all those sources in the show notes, because I definitely want to give credit to the people that were super detailed mm-hmm. when they did their research, and it helped me do my research. But yeah, really, really great case. Thanks, Becca, for the recommendation.
Yeah.
Hope we did it justice. And yeah, OCPD, by the way, if anyone doesn't know, that is not a disorder that typically is associated with crime or, you know, any violence. So I thought that was really interesting that mm-hmm. he was diagnosed with that. And then that was what they were trying to use, especially the professionals trying to use that. But again, right. It was the early 90s. Again, I think that was a very new personality disorder that was newly developed, not newly developed, but newly described, I guess, sure. in that time. So maybe they did think that it was like antisocial or narcissistic personality disorder.
Yeah, similar to other personality disorders. And then being, as it is, like, just over-explaining, maybe, trying to get the jury to understand maybe certain aspects from professionals that might not have known too much about it at the time. So mm-hmm. so. Yeah. Blind leading the blind there, perhaps. So,
well, the good news is we are continuing to find advancements in not only forensic technology for criminal cases, but mental health development and research and stuff like that. So yeah. I think it'll only get better with the accuracy of cases like this. And
yeah.
And hopefully in the future we can limit cases like this with treatment.
Right.
Early on. Anything else?
Nope, that's it.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us for another case. We'll see you guys next week.
Okay.
Love you.
Bye.
Born and brewed in Southern California since 1963, the Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf has always been passionate about connecting loyal customers with carefully handcrafted products. Their coffee master, Jay Isaias, only selects the top 1% of Arabica beans from the world's best-growing regions, giving customers the best quality product every time. Whether you're looking for a dark roast to liven up your day or a soothing tea to relax into the night, the Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf has it all. Click the link in our show notes today to access an exclusive offer and get sipping.